Hi, y'all. If you're not familiar with North Carolina or Southern lingo, that means hello, everyone. My name is Emily, and I'm here to talk to you guys about a pilot program that we conducted at Centro Latino in Hickory, North Carolina, titled Nutrición y Zumba. Myself, Dr. Guerreau, and a few other students at Lenoir Ryan, and with the help of the community, we were able to put this program together. I do not have any relationships to disclose. I would like to acknowledge this wonderful group of people that we had help us with the brainstorming, implementation, and providing support and translations. Elizabeth, the first person listed, she is the director at Centro Latino, and she was a huge help. And then we also had Michelle Reimer. She is the director for the SOLMATS Institute for Obesity. This is a new institute at Lenoir Ryan University. And then we have a few other MPH students. And then Dr. Adelia Parado-Ortiz, she's an assistant professor at Lenoir Ryan, and she was a huge contribution as far as translating and working with these women in the community. I want to provide you guys with a little bit of background of North Carolina and Hickory, or Catawba County specifically. As you can see, the University of North Carolina did a study on women's health and found that 27% of Latinas in North Carolina over the age of 18 are considered obese. A lot of these women face work constraints and family and time management. They don't necessarily have the time to be physically active, and they might not have the resources or the knowledge to prepare healthy meals for their families or for themselves, and they don't always necessarily have a medical home. In 2009, Catawba County, which is where Hickory, North Carolina is located, ranked and these numbers are a little bit off. I was going to go in and switch, but the idea of changing numbers right before the presentation scared me a little bit. So North Carolina actually ranks 389 as of 2009 of all the counties in the U.S. for the number of Hispanic and Latinos. And this is a 90% growth since 2000 and a 756% growth since 1990. And the number for 1990 was actually 866. Hickory is a very rural area. There aren't a ton of resources. There are resources, but it's not a very resource-rich area. And so being aware of the data that we have on the area and conversations with Elizabeth, who is the director at Centro Latino, and she's very involved in the Hispanic community in Hickory. So being aware of all of the background that we had and the conversations that were held, she expressed the need to us that these women had of education regarding general health, nutrition, and physical activity. And that's when the brainstorming process began. So the conversations that we had raised our awareness of the racism, stigmas, and acculturation and immigration struggles that these women face on a daily basis. And therefore, we didn't want to add on to the stress by focusing only on these women's weight. We wanted to make sure that we are including health, the entirety of health. We wanted to our interactions with these women to encompass the health at any size approach, and we wanted to educate on health issues surrounding nutrition in order to empower the women to make changes for themselves and for their families. This is just a little brief description about the program. We had three goals: increasing the local Latinas' awareness of their own health indicators, determine if the program will lead to weight loss, and to gather insight from the women about their experience. With the help of volunteer and graduate and undergraduate students and professors at Lenoir Ryan University and the after-school coordinator, which was Elizabeth at Centro Latino, and community workers, the program was conducted on-site at Centro Latino two nights a week for approximately 2 hours each night. The women were able to participate for free in a three-month pilot program, which combined bilingual nutrition classes, Zumba fitness classes, and healthy Latino cooking lessons. Women participating in at least 90% of this program were received certificates of achievement. And we did avoid monetary incentives, as Elizabeth, the director, felt like this would decrease the participants' intrinsic motivation. And like I said, the women were able to participate in these classes. And we also provided cooking lessons. And we wanted to make sure that we weren't just going in and saying, you need to eat salads and you need to eat turkey sandwiches. We wanted to take into account what foods that they were used to eating. So a lot of the women did say that tacos and quesadillas, those were very common in their diet, so we didn't want to come in there and say, stop eating those. We wanted to say, hey, maybe instead of using beef that you use turkey or you use a leaner meat. And we also provided the women with cookbooks. So we still kept in mind the culture of the people that we were working with, and we kept in mind their recipes, and we just made slight alterations that would make them a little bit more healthier. We also provided portion size information and nutrition label reading. A lot of these women weren't aware of healthier options and weren't complete. I think even myself personally, reading a nutrition label can be a little bit confusing. And so if you are reading something that's in an entirely different language, I mean, I can't even imagine how difficult that might be. So we just wanted to help them understand what it was that they were looking at so that they can make those choices themselves. This is just a view of the bilingual nutrition classes that were offered, and at the top you can see a picture of the women participating in the Zumba classes. And these classes were conducted by myself, Dr. Garreau, and Michelle Reimer, and they focused on heart health, nutrition label reading, diabetes prevention, childhood obesity prevention, maternal nutrition. A lot of the women who were participating in the program were pregnant, and so they wanted to know what they could do while they were pregnant to make healthier choices for themselves and their pregnancy, but then also once their children were born. And then, like I said, the healthy Hispanic cooking lessons. IRB approval is obtained from Lenoir Rhyne University. Bilingual informed consent and assent forms are signed prior to data collection. Women participating in at least 90% of the program were asked to complete a follow-up survey, and this was conducted by Elizabeth at the center, and she wanted to find from the women what they felt were one benefit and one recommendation of the program. Although the children were not the focus of the pre- and post-measurements, they were collected if they are desired by the family or if the mother wanted that collected. We had 82 women participating in the three-month program. However, only 10 women participated in at least 90% of the sessions. Mean weight and waist circumference, in addition to BMI, were analyzed. Although, as we've learned, that this is not a very accurate assessment of someone's true health, it's what can be done easily with limited resources. And one-tailed dependent and sample t-tests were run to test mean and waist circumference loss for women completing at 90% of the sessions. For our results, weight data from the sample, and that number 55 are the women that were there on the very first day of the program, and this is the day we had the greatest turnout. And from these women, 14% were categorized as normal, 47% were classified as overweight, and 30% were obese. There was significant mean weight loss for the women who did participate in 90% of the program, and there was somewhat circumference loss. However, with a larger size, it might have been more significant. These are the survey results that Elizabeth found and that we were able to analyze, and this is what was really important to us, what the women felt like they were getting out of the program, what they felt like they would be able to share with their families. And I won't read through all of these, but the most important thing that we learned and that we gathered from the women is that they were very enthusiastic about what they were learning. They felt like they were able to make changes within their own families, and they were very eager to go out into the community and to spread what they learned. They knew that not many people in the community were able to have the ability to go to Centro Latino. It's a very small representation of the entire community, so they wanted to be able to take what they had learned and go out into the community and be lay health educators. So these are some of the conclusions that obesity is a significant health issue for the women in this area. Weight loss was observed for 90%, but more importantly, within the Health at Every Size approach, these women perceived the program to have several benefits other than weight loss. There were several limitations to this program. Fortunately and unfortunately, we had volunteers. It's wonderful having volunteers, especially at a small college in North Carolina, who are willing to give their time for free. However, we didn't have necessarily the training that was needed in assessing BMI or gathering that waist circumference information. There are tougher laws in the neighboring states led to some fear within the women about coming forward and being out in the public with us. And then, like I said before, the effect for waist circumference indicated with a larger sample that maybe more results would have been significant. We do feel like this program would be more successful, the health at any size approach, if we had more funding. Unfortunately, shortly after this, Central Latino lost a significant amount of their funding, and they've had to be relocated. So at the time, the program is sort of halted, but we are seeking funding for further programs. And this intervention suggests that health at every size approach may be successful for women who face significant barriers, including access to care, stigma, and acculturation. So we knew that these women were already under an enormous amount of stress from many different areas in their life, and we didn't want to add to that by focusing solely on their weight. That's why we wanted to incorporate all of the different nutrition lessons. That is all. Thank you very much. The women did approach us, and they said that they knew that there were healthier, what they thought from watching TV and that sort of thing, that there were healthy options, but they weren't exactly sure about how to go about implementing those into their lives. And so that's why we had the lessons to show them ways that they could implement it, and then they wanted something to take home so that they could have and they could practice that with their families.
Any questions for the panel at large?
Okay, so I'm sorry, I can't feel like I can't see you over the thing there. You know, I think there's a possibility. There isn't, to my knowledge, an overt relationship between people who are doing food addiction work and people doing a Hayes model. I think it really depends on how the food addiction work is approached. My understanding is that there's a whole variety of different models out there of people who work with the concept of food addiction. And if it's a weight-neutral approach, it could be consistent with the Hayes model, perhaps. But I think the way it's implemented often is that it's a substitute for it's a form of a diet approach or a weight loss approach. You know, the reason you're fat is that you have a food addiction, and come to our program and cure your addiction and then you'll be thin. That would not be consistent with the Hayes model. But I'm aware that there are food addiction models that are more weight neutral. So I guess I would really need to know exactly what somebody was doing to know whether it was consistent with a Hayes approach or not. I don't think it's an answer that I could make, I feel that I could make across the board, and I wouldn't want to, you know, damn everything or praise everything, because I just don't think it's possible. I don't know if others have.
Well, and I think a lot of times, at least in some of the literature I've seen, that food addiction is kind of conflated with binge eating, you know, that they're somehow seen as the same thing. But what we know is one of the major correlates with someone engaging in binging is whether they've engaged in restrictive dieting. So if they're engaging in restrictive dieting, that's going to be more likely to lead to a binge. So we see that there are programs that are saying, well, what you need to do is restrict your food, that's, you know, either for the purpose of weight loss, but that's not necessarily efficacious, depending on the eating concern.
I
in fact, if that is the framing, I obviously don't need a mic. If that is the framing, that is totally inconsistent with the health at every size approach. Totally inconsistent. Sorry.
Yeah. Just consistent with what gets recorded.
Yeah, I work at a large public hospital trying to implement a wellness program and not identify outcomes based on BMI or weight or something. Does anyone now have identified metrics?
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about Linda's research?
Yeah, I was going to say Linda Bacon has done quite a bit of research. She is at San Diego State, and she is a nutritionist. No longer San Diego State?
No, that's your city college master who's at San Diego State. Linda was at Davis originally and is here in San Francisco now.
Okay, my apologies. But she has done intervention work using the Health at Every Size approach and comparing a group of women who engaged in the Health at Every Size intervention versus a traditional dieting intervention, and ended up seeing certain metabolic outcomes that were better in the group that were part of the Health at Every Size intervention, and that those behavioral changes were longer lasting than those women in the traditional dieting control group.
Just to add to that, she used both quantitative and qualitative measures. So she used traditional health metrics like cholesterol, blood sugar, blood pressure. I'm probably leaving something out. They did actually measure weight, but they didn't use it as a measure of health. And then they also used qualitative studies. There's a lot of qualitative instruments out there for measuring, for example, self-efficacy, body esteem, body image, those kinds of things. And she did a 1- and 2-year follow-up, and at the 1 year, the weight loss group had lost weight and improved on just about every metric, both qualitative and quantitative. And at the 1 year measure, the Hayes group had, Hayes being the acronym for Health at Every Size, the Hayes group had not lost weight, but they had improved on all the metrics. At 2 years, the weight loss group had gained back their weight, and all the other metrics had gone down. And at 2 years, the Health at Every Size group were still at the same weight, and all their metrics had stayed high. So it was just it's very persuasive evidence. Her research has been duplicated in a couple of studies that have been published since, and there's a couple of other studies that are underway, looking to duplicate and see whether they get the same results. So it's pretty persuasive. She talks about it at length in her book, which is called Health at Every Size.
And if I could say, I know that sometimes the concern is about trying to convince funders that what you're doing has some efficacy to it. And one thing that I've talked about with others is a larger framing of what health actually is that includes things like quality of life, mental health outcomes, some of those things that are an inherent part, an enjoyment of physical activity, an enjoyment of the food that you eat, that can be seen as more holistic measures of health and quality of life experiences than just a pounds gained or pounds lost or waist circumference gained or lost.
Okay.
Yes.
Can the mic go this far? So I just wanted to take a minute and make a couple of clarifications. So if a program or an intervention has a weight loss component as a goal or an outcome, is measuring weight loss as something that is in their goals, it is not a Health at Every Size intervention. So there might be a little confusion. I'm not going to pick on Emily here, but the program she presented is actually not a Health at Every Size intervention. While there might be some components of those elements in what they did, which is fabulous, it is actually incorrect to lump weight loss in any form if you're going to refer to what you're doing as a Health at Every Size program. And I think it's really important for you guys to be aware of that because many people have started co-opting the principles let me rephrase that. Many people have co-opted the term health at every size or health at any size to apply to a program which actually does have a goal of weight loss. And the health at every size, the organization of ATSA, which is the Association for Size Diversity and Health, is a professional educational organization that is made up of individuals who are committed to the health at every size principles, both in their personal lives and in their professional work. And so we actually received a trademark for the term health at every size because we wanted to protect it from being co-opted. So when you look at programs, if you really want to look for health at every size interventions and how to do that work, I would really suggest that you look at the contents of the program and the focus of the goals. If the pursuit of weight loss is part of the program, that's inconsistent with the health at every size weight neutral approach. So I think it's very important that you know that. Weight neutrality is really about, as Fall would say, re-empowerment of people to really listen to their own bodies, to learn about intuitive and attuned eating, to learn about what feeds their soul and their bodies in terms of physical activity, and go moves away from doing the stigmatization. The size bias is rampant in our public health field, sadly, and certainly in my field of fitness. As a fitness instructor, guess what? I'm fat. I've been a fitness instructor for years and years and years. And all of those behaviors that my many health practitioners would like to attribute to me because of my body size, they're not part of my life. Those that promote health are part of my life. That's my individual choice. But I would really plead with people to do not make assumptions based on what you see when someone walks in for your assistance. Listen to them. Ask them about their behaviors and what they want to accomplish, and do everything in your power to help them come from a place of peace with their bodies and nurturing that is very self-loving and self-caring. Okay, I'll get off my soapbox.
Despite the fact that that was a wonderful summative statement, we still have time to discuss.
Thank you.
Yeah,
more.
You know, I buy everything except that. And even yet, you have to do a double-blind study and randomize people to eat to get heavier and not, maybe, if that's what you're saying, I mean, it's true from an epidemiological point of view, but from a physiologic and biologic point of view, our hearts have to work much, much harder if we're pumping through more pounds. Our bones, our joints, have to hold up under more weight. And I can buy even just staying at the same weight. But if we're on a trajectory where we're constantly increasing our weight, that's not healthy. So I definitely buy, and I absolutely agree with, why push stuff that doesn't work, and diets don't work. I agree completely. But for a physician, it needs to still recognize with the patient if you have, whether it's a cancer or bad dental disease,
I think, and I'm sure other panelists will have many things to say. Well, there's some assumptions that we might have heard in terms of body size continually increasing, and in fact, that has leveled off as of about 2005. So the idea that there's some ceiling and we're just going to get larger and larger and larger, that's actually not the case. The other thing is that we often, the National Association for the Advancement of Fat Acceptance has a wonderful toolkit four physicians and medical providers about working with patients with size. And one of the major questions that they encourage medical providers to think about is, what if you have a fat person in your office, what is the, and they present to you with a health problem, what solution would you give to a thin person? So if someone comes in and says, my knees hurt, your solution to a thin person might be, well, let's get you into physical therapy and work on those muscles that can really help support, you know, your knees and make that, you know, less of a concern for you. Well, that prescription is going to be just as useful for a fat person, whereas telling them you need to lose 50 pounds is harmful in many ways and not efficacious. So we see, again, despite the fact that there have been trends that say obesity has gotten higher and higher over the past 30 to 40 years, we also see the trends, and again, correlation is not causation, but we're also healthier than we've ever been. Heart disease is way down, smoking is way down, we're taller, you know, we're fitter, you know, in terms of looking at large-scale epidemiological trends, and I can see the doubt on your face, these are two facts that are kind of, if you buy into the weight equals health paradigm, those are actually in conflict. And so, I don't know if anyone else wants to...
Oh, go ahead. Yeah.
I know we have one more question, so I don't want to spend a ton more time. We can certainly talk individually with each of us if you have more questions. One suggestion that we've been giving to people when we got pushed back into the search, something called the obesity paradox, which keeps appearing in research, which is where these ideas that we hold about obesity equals health, we keep finding conflicting research about it, and we keep finding that, you know, for some people, higher body weight is protective. We can talk about things like bone density or some heart disease studies. So if you just search obesity paradox, there's actually a lot of research where the scientists sort of said, well, we found this thing where obesity wasn't bad, and we're confused, and we call it the obesity paradox. Anyway, just Google that. That's sort of one of my suggestions. I wanted to get to, like, one last person with another question, though. I saw one more hand before we go. Does someone else have a question?
In addition, I would, you know, agree with both of those points, and then also to look at there's a body of studies. I think one of the best ones out there in terms of methods is by Wildman, is the lead author, Wildman, who looked at metabolic fitness and body weight and found that over 34% of people in the, quote, obese categories of BMI were categorized in their study as metabolically fit. And if weight is always causing of poor health, how do you explain those 35% of people in the, you know, higher levels of BMI? Her study's been, you know, those results are pretty consistent. There's also a lot of thin people who are really unhealthy, and when we're using BMI as a standard for, you know, diagnosis, basically, we're doing a huge disservice to people who get a free pass, who don't get certain tests or certain attention, or who's, I talked with one woman who didn't get a diagnosis of diabetes quickly enough because she was thin, and the doctor sort of didn't really believe what he was seeing. So there's just these weird ways that we're using weight instead of health. And, you know, where's the problem with just focusing on health? If someone is metabolically unfit, let's deal with that. Let's find ways for that person to start moving her body better and develop metabolic fitness, but let's not shame her because she's fat. Let's not try to make her do weight loss programs that aren't going to work and are going to make her feel like a failure. And then there's another piece that's really interesting. When you look at population studies, the longest lived people are the people in what we call overweight BMI, people with a BMI of 25 to 29 across populations, across cultures, live longer than really thin people, and they live longer than really fat people, but that doesn't fit with what we're told by the general public health. So there's just a lot of information out there. You know, not everyone's going to agree with us, but, you know, there's more to the story than what we're being told in the headlines.
Time is it?
Yes, after 2.
Okay, well, we want to make sure that everyone has time to get over to hear Angela Davis speak. So we're up here for a few.